You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and I can't believe that 2024 marks 10 years of podcasting. Over the last decade, I have had the pleasure of talking with hundreds upon hundreds of passionate outdoors men and women who share the same excitement for hunting as I do. Whether you hunt public lands or private property, shoot traditional archery equipment or high-powered rifles, we all have one thing in common. And that's our love for the great outdoors. This year, I plan on continuing that tradition and bringing educational and entertaining content to your ears. Thank you for your continued support, and I hope you all have the best seasons of your life. Good vibes in, good vibes out. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and today's episode is brought to you by Tethered, Wasp, Vortex, Code Blue, Woodman's Pal, Huntworth, and of course, Full Sneak Gear. Today's guest is another fellow Iowan. His name is Caleb, and here we go. This is the true test. Karstarferson? Karstarferson. Okay, I added another syllable. Yep. Karstarferson.
Yeah, that's okay.
All right. That might be one of, I'm going to say top 10. I'm knocking on 900 episodes of the Nine Finger Chronicles, and that might be top 10 most complicated last names that I've had.
Yep. I get that a lot.
Caleb, how you doing, man?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good, man. What do you do for a living?
So I am a construction project manager for a remodel company in Des Moines.
Yep.
Do pretty much everything: basements, bathrooms, kitchens, exterior remodels, whole home remodels, you name it, we do it.
Yeah,
I've been doing that for a while. I've been in the like new construction scene, did a lot of project management for production building and also custom home building as well. So
gotcha. All right. Des Moines, Iowa. And so right now there's all these people listening to this and they're going, oh, Dan Johnson, that guy's in Iowa. He's got it so easy. Oh, Caleb, he's from Iowa too. He's got it so easy. And we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, success, what the definition of success is for, you know, us in a given year, and how that might change throughout the course of a hunting career and things like that. Let's see here. Have you always been in that Des Moines, Ankeny area of the state?
Yep. Pretty much just central Iowa. Actually grew up in Perry, Iowa. Yep. That's my hometown. And I've just been kind of around that area my entire life.
So. Gotcha. And so I had a conversation with someone a while ago about, you know, the term, I'm a product of my environment, right? And so I just so happened to be born in Iowa. I just, happened to find a career or, you know, find family and career here in Iowa. And so it's not like I have chosen to make things harder for me. You know, Iowa is a really good state to deer hunt in. And so that's when I say I'm a product of my environment as far as what I've been able to hunt and what I can hunt every year as far as age class right. and antler size and things like that. Is there any misconceptions that there might be out there in your opinion about the state of Iowa?
Everybody thinks that Iowa is like the state for big whitetails mm-hmm. and don't get me wrong. It is a good state, but there is a lot of other good states, you know, around Iowa. You look at Missouri, even there's big deer up in Minnesota, Illinois, Nebraska. I think, you know, there's big deer everywhere. I mean, you go, it doesn't have to just be Iowa. I think when there's a lot of out of state guys that are trying to, you know, get in here and hunt, which is fine. You know, there's opportunity. And I think that there's any misconceptions, I think it would be that per square mile, like around here, it's like, you think you're going to find like these 200 inch deer all the time. And like, I've only seen a couple in my lifetime and I live in Iowa. Mm-hmm. I've only gotten to ever like shoot at one and I missed. So, which sucks, but yeah.
I'll elaborate on that just a little bit. And I'll say that Iowa is great. If you are south of I-80, if you are a landowner and you have the ability to manage deer, that is the pinnacle. That's where everybody, you know, all the attention is focused on these large farms. You know, I've had this conversation several times now where the baseline for Iowa is because of our rules and regulations and our population, the baseline for Iowa is higher than most, but, and, you know, we don't have the hunting numbers like Michigan, as far as residents are concerned. We don't have Michigan, Pennsylvania, New York. We don't have those resident hunter numbers, which again makes this, but I think the misconception comes where people look at Iowa from afar and they go, oh dude, Iowa is, where I want to be. Well, when you get here, good luck finding a place to hunt. Because number one, leasing, outfitting, you know, the people who are now landowners in the best, you know, the best parts of the state, don't let anybody hunt anymore. The ability to knock on doors and find access is as close to zero as I've ever have found it. I'm sure there's places out there, but the cat is out of the bag about Iowa, and it's been out about Iowa for over 10 years now, and its attraction has caused money to flood into this state and for people to secure up land, whether you're a resident or a non-resident. And so people are forced out to the better part, like the not as good, it's still good, but not as good parts of the state. Certain parts of the state have little to no public land, and so the public land that we do have that does hold good deer is, you know, during the rut, it's hard to hunt. And so the don't always believe what you see is what I would say.
Right. Yeah, I would agree to that for sure. It's when you talked about like knocking on doors and stuff, that's like, that has gotten so hard mm-hmm. now. I remember growing up, going out with my dad, and we'd be able to knock on, you know, local farmers' doors that, you know, they might have 10, 15, 20 acres. You know, we'd tell them like, hey, we're just bow hunters. We just want to hunt. And they're like, sure, go ahead.
Yeah.
And now, like, I do that now. I always get a no. Yeah. And I still knock door to door. Like, I'll still do it. Like, it's like, what's the worst that can happen? Like,
yeah.
Say no, or you might get lucky and you might get a yes. And thankfully, you know, a couple of the spots that I do hunt, I did have that luck with getting that yes, and it's been great. Yeah. I've had success on those areas. And don't get me wrong, I still hunt public land and everything. And around here, it's tough. The public land around here is pressured, but still try to make it work.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, there is a silver lining to the thunderstorm, right? So there's always that, you know, there's always a chance that you can get access, but it's always no if you don't go and knock on the door. So that's one thing that I've noticed. I shouldn't say I've noticed, but I've realized over the course of the last, I don't know, three or four seasons, really, it's kind of sunk in that I am going to need to do something to, you know, I got a farm that I have solid access to, where that property's not going to go away. As far as I know, it's not going to go away. It's not going to be sold. And I'm going to be able to hunt it. The other farm that I've been hunting for however many years, it's always a flip of a coin. Like, my gut tells me so every year when I go to talk with a landowner, you know, I stop and talk to her multiple times, and I'm just like, hey, so, you know, I just, how are things on the farm? You know, I'm an automatic yes to her every single year, right? I've been hunting that farm so long. I've built a good relationship with that landowner, and my gut tells me it's going to get sold, or there's multiple landowners on. She's just one of the landowners. All the other ones are spread out all over the country. And, I don't know. It's tough to know whether or not next year, am I going to be able to hunt this farm? And right. So far it's treated me really well, but it's a great farm. There's a little bit of hunting pressure on it. I share it with a couple other hunters right now, but every year I feel like I'm going to lose it.
Yeah. What's your take on having to share it?
I don't like for me, it's either that or I don't have it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I have a good relationship with a landowner, and let's say I was a very greedy person and I said, hey, listen, I don't want to share this with anybody else anymore. I will lease it. I think that would actually be a huge turnoff for them, for the landowner.
Yeah.
I think that she is happy with the current people that she has hunting on her farm. And I feel like she is one of those landowners. Like, you hear these stories. Okay. I have a story for you from, man, when I was still in high school, one of my good friends, his grandpa owned a ton of acres. Okay. And I got permission to deer hunt on it. And, oh man, I lost it because a non-resident, you know, this was the direction that I was going with it. There was a very big company in the hunting industry back then that approached him. And the rumor is this is what he says. Now, he's 90 when he's 90 years old when he's telling this story. Yeah. So somebody from this company stopped at my door and they showed me a briefcase full of money, like $500,000 or something ridiculous back then, ridiculous. And he said, I shut the door in their face. I said, get off my property. Right. There's still some of those landowners in Iowa that believe that this land should be farmed first and people should be making their living off the land. And now some could argue that deer management and shooting big bucks is a way to make a living, you know, hoarding the resource, you know, some people are hoarding the resource. Maybe that's a bad way to explain it, but they don't want to see what's happening everywhere else happen on their land. And so they give residents access to their ground. They let a variety of different people use it, whether it's mushroom hunt, turkey hunt, deer hunt, you know, whatever the case may be, trap on it. They let people do that, and they don't want it turned into, into limited resources, or see other locals get displaced from the lack of hunting.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's tough, man. I've talked about this the last couple episodes where I'm just, you know, right now the thing that I'm thinking about the most is where are my kids gonna hunt, right? Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know. So let's get into what the topic is today, and so, which is kind of a BS session, but you were talking to me a little bit before we started recording about how you grew up the old school way with a dad who took you to double ladder stands on field edges and things like that. Yep. And so, let's talk a little bit about that transition. 'Cause this is the thing that I love focusing on because it happened to me, right? I used to be the field edge hunter. I used to be the ladder stand guy. And then all of a sudden I ran into some people who were mobile hunters. They schooled me to the game. And now, and then I started being more mobile. What was that factor for you when it comes to going from stationary hunting, same place, same winds every single time, to being mobile, picking up the right gear, playing around with that equipment, and then ultimately finding success from that change?
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, so I, like you said, hunting those same stands, same winds, you know, being a younger guy not really focusing on the wind. It's like, you know, sometimes you see stuff, sometimes you don't, and wasn't really factoring in that wind when I was a younger guy. Mm-hmm. And started, you know, how everybody does now these days is like YouTube's such a big,
yeah,
YouTube, Instagram, you name it. There's guys out there that are doing this, and that's kind of what got me into it. I see these guys, you know, like the DeQuistos for sure. You know, they're super mobile, and watching them, seeing the success that they have, I'm like, I want to do that.
Yeah,
and you know, I picked up, I think just like a, you know, a cheap hang on stand. I think it was like a big game stand, a couple of sticks, and just started going. And there's a big learning curve, mm-hmm. from, you know, where I started to where I'm at now. As far as, you know, looking at sign, following tracks, a big one was actually just scouting, yeah. more than actually hunting.
Yeah. So when you, how many years did that take? So, you know, you told me that you're 29 years old, right?
Yep.
Okay.
We'll be. Okay.
All right. Yeah. So how old were you when you broke away from the ladder stand stationary type hunting to the more mobile, approach?
I probably would have been, let's see, junior in high school.
Okay.
So what, you're like 16, 17, somewhere in there, yeah, 16, 17
years old. And yeah. so, and now fast forward 12 years, you're sitting on 12 years worth of hunting experience. Now,
yep.
I got to say something. All right. I made a comment. I believe I talked about this already too, but I made a comment about, content. And that content was coming, and the example that I used was a 25-year-old interviewing another 25-year-old about hunting strategy and stuff like that. And the whole point of that conversation was about how there are people out there, and I'm not saying all people, there are people out there that are young trying to give advice that probably don't have any, I don't know, they don't have enough weight behind what they're trying to say. Yep. Okay. They don't have the experience that, you know, someone in 35, 45, 55, 65, you go on forever. But what I didn't mention, and I probably should have, is that experience comes at different levels, at different ages, and things like that. So I didn't start off. So the 26-year-old version of me, when I first started taking deer hunting serious, is not what you were when you were 26. Because when you were 26, you had 10 years of mobile hunting experience already. Okay? I didn't have shit when I was 26. I had no experience. So I started, just because someone's younger doesn't mean that they have less hunting experience, okay? And so that's one thing I probably should have mentioned, because I got kind of my ass chewed online for posting a clip about that. And so I always look back and I say, I wish I would have known some of these things earlier. My wall, I'd have way more deer on my wall than I currently do. But what was that like, kind of making that decision as a 16, 17-year-old to break away from, like, why did you break away from that stationary type of hunting in order to get more mobile? Why?
I think one reason was I kind of wanted to show off to my dad, at least.
Yeah.
Kind of be like, hey, like, you know, you've taught me all this stuff. I still do it to this day. You know, every time I shoot something, he's like one of the first guys I call, you know, and he knows during the season, you know, what I'm after, what I'm looking at, what I have on trail camera. But yeah, that was kind of the big thing, was like, take what he taught me and put it to good use, but then see if I can, you know, excel and just try to do it better than him, which is, he never took it as, like, you know, an insult, because I hope, you know, when my son gets older, I hope he's a, you know, 50 times better deer hunter than I am, you know.
Yeah.
That was the main thing, why I got away from it. I just kind of wanted to prove to him
there's other ways of doing it.
Yep. And he's still the old school way. He's still, you know, we'll set these big stands, and he's older now, you know, he's in his 60s. So he's had two hip replacements. He's just looking looking for the easy way. He's not going to climb up, you know, a small little ladder to get on into a little, you know, hang on stand, or even attempt to get into a saddle, which is what I hunt out of now.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. All right. Okay, so from 16 to now, talk to me a little bit about some of the struggles that you went through learning the mobile game.
Being quiet is the big thing.
Being quiet. You or your gear?
My gear. Holy cow, like that was a big thing. Like, when you have those, like, cheap, you know, little hang on stands, and you're trying to, you know, tie them sticks onto the back, and on top of carrying, you know, your pack that, you know, you have your knife, grunt tube, might have some kind of rattling pack of some sort. Like, I carry real antlers now, but that was the big thing. I was blowing deer out all the time.
Yeah.
Another struggle was still trying to, you know, work the wind for the areas that I was hunting, because some of these spots that I have, like, I have access to get into where I want to go, but just that wind, man, is, I would just go in, I could have the, wouldn't even think about it, wind would be at my back in the morning, I'm banging around stuff on my pack, and I can hear everything blowing out on me, and I'm like, dang, like, not going to see anything. And that was a big struggle for a long time, was figuring out how to get my gear quiet, for one. The next thing, was, you know, trying to understand and read terrain. Mm-hmm. You know, because any guy can go in and march through the woods and be like, you know, I'm mobile. Yeah, I'm moving around through the woods, you know, but really is
mobile doesn't understanding... mean that you're going to find success.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I took a long time to kind of figure that out. And now it's, you know, I'm trying to still learning terrain and, mm-hmm. you know, everything. Now I've pretty good grasp on it, what to look for, like when I'm looking at Onyx on my phone or on the computer.
Gotcha. All right, so with that said then, are you okay, the mobile, I want to talk about the gear a little bit. Now the gear was loud. What steps did you take to make yourself more quiet?
You know, like that, like felt tape, mm-hmm. you know, the back, what's like the, when I had
roll of it right here, this,
yeah, there we go.
Yep. Stealth tape.
Yep. Yep. Stealth it. Tape. Stealth yeah. Tape. Yep. So they had this, this was like a little bit older stuff. Cause that stuff's good stuff.
Yeah.
Even, I use it now. This stuff, it's similar. It was almost like a little more, like the felt was a little bit more like cushy.
Yeah.
So I like that stuff. Like I can't find that anymore.
Yeah.
So I started putting that stuff like on my sticks, mm-hmm. Using paracord, trying to tie things up. And it's kind of funny. I got to a point where, you know, I get everything tied down. So this was kind of like my next issue was, you know, I was quiet. I got to the point where my gear wasn't clanking around or anything.
Yep.
The crappy part was, you know, when I got to an area I wanted to hunt was having to untie everything.
Yeah.
I didn't have a good way of keeping it. I had a good way of keeping it quiet, but then the speed from getting to where I wanted to be and then getting up a tree always just took so long,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, man, I'll be honest. It took me several seasons to get to the point. Okay. So when I was truly mobile, and I mean 100% mobile, when I had like two lone wolf stands and two sets of sticks, that's all I had, two assaults and eight sticks, basically. That's all I had for multiple seasons. And so I would go in and I would set one up preseason before the season even started to in a rut funnel. And then I would have my run and gun set. And on the best conditions, I would go to that pre-hung stand. But a majority of the time, I was making moves, right? And so it took me several seasons to find the right way to put a pack on, a stand on a pack, and then sticks on that stand. And for the longest time, I had all of that stacked on my back on a backpack that I bought at like Cabela's or Walmart for dirt cheap. I mean, it was a horrible. Long story short, it was a school backpack with camo on it, and that's why I bought it. So it was dirt cheap. And then over the years, when my gear started to upgrade, when I started to upgrade on my gear, you know, buy better packs, buy some of the stealth tape or hockey tape to wrap up, make things a little more quiet. I learned that I don't like having my sticks on my back. I like having them on my hip in a bow holder. And so when I do that, I get to the tree and I just slide off the sticks and I start stacking the sticks, and then I can pull my, and then I clip my bow rope to my bow, I set it down, I connect the string to the belt loop, and then I mm-hmm. climb up the tree with my sticks, pull my stand off my back, that's just hanging there, it's not strapped down or anything because of the shoulder straps, pull it off, hang it up, get in this stand, pull my bow rope up. And I'm to the point now where I can do that in like a 5 minute period if the tree cooperates. Now there's other times where it'll take me longer if it's a crooked tree, if it's lots of low branches, or if it's I'm trying to think of what the tree is. I think it's a pin oak. If of the pin oak of all sizes has so much, so like a very high stem count, and it's hard to get up in there, or, you know, any other scrub type tree. And so then it takes a little bit longer, but it probably took me 6 years to figure out what I liked. And then, and I don't necessarily know if it was, how do I put this? I don't know if it was the gear, but what I found, yes, it was quieter. Yes, I was more efficient in tearing it, you know, tearing down and setting up. But I found what I call like a comfortable bubble. And that is how close I can get to these deer without, if I do click a buckle on, my stand, it's not going to, the deer aren't going to get spooked and run away. Right. I like to set up in a line, in that line somewhere, not so close to where they're bedding that I run a risk of spooking them, but putting myself in a position that when they stand up out of their bed, they're going to be heading my direction because of wind, because of thermals, because of terrain. Right. And so that takes a little bit longer to figure out than just, you know, walking into the woods and setting up a tree stand. So,
yeah.
Okay. So the quietness part. Now, on top of that quietness, you start to figure that out. What was your learning curve with things like terrain, where to set up, how to set up, access routes? Okay. Learning how to play the wind and reading thermals.
So, yeah. So Onyx is awesome. Mm-hmm. I love that you have that feature in your pocket now on your phone. So I've been learning, you know, studying terrain features. I really like, as far as like terrain features go, is like those, the draws that you can see in the timber. Mm-hmm. So hunting those draws in the timber, figuring out like hubs and the ridges, but what did I want to say?
So when it comes to like your strategy, how long did it take you to learn where to set up without getting busted?
It wasn't like years and years to really figure that out. Yeah. I think,
here, I'll let you think about it, because for me, I think if I had, I truly think that I had too much ground to hunt to think about. So I made the change to becoming a mobile hunter. And then I had, at the time, I probably had 2,300 acres of access throughout the county that I lived in. And so I had all this access to this ground, and I didn't focus on one particular property. And I think that if I had focused on one property and tried to figure it out and then apply those principles to other properties, I feel like my learning curve would have been shorter. However, I liked to bounce around to virgin sits every single time. And it took me longer because I wasn't focused on one deer per se, or one single property. I had multiple properties all over the county that I was trying to hunt. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yep. So not, it didn't take you years and years and years, but how long did it take you?
I mean, it probably took me at least one season for sure. Like that, when I first started getting into it, that first season, you know, was I think the big learning curve. And I, you know, these places that I'm hunting, they're not giant places. So I don't have a lot of area that I can go and,
yeah,
you know, check out, you know.
How many acres are we talking about on an average size farm you hunt?
No more than 40.
Okay, so you're dealing with fairly small parcels.
Very, Yeah, I consider that pretty small compared to what some of these guys that got hundreds of acres. I'm like, yeah. I've never stepped foot, at least on not private. I mean, yeah. Public land, sure. There's some big public land, and that can be very daunting. Mm-hmm. And I've tried it. I feel more comfortable on the private land, not just because of other hunters, but just success wise too. You get in those big areas and you got hundreds of dudes just all over. Mm-hmm. That's always a hard one to deal with, you know. But yeah, 40 acres, some are smaller than that. I mean, that's honestly probably one of the bigger ones.
Okay. So you were able to focus on single pieces of property, because although 40 acres to some people may sound like a big piece of timber, the number of terrain features within that 40 acres, probably there's not over 10. I mean, do you have 10 tree stand locations in 40 acres?
No.
Yeah.
No. I got like maybe 4, 5. Yeah. If that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Okay. So 1-2 seasons in order to, you know, figure out some of the places where the deer were coming from, what the deer, what your access route needed to be.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Did you have any aha moments that really impacted your strategy every year?
That's a good question. I still have aha moments. Yeah. I had one. I had them past season too. Like I'm always finding those like aha moments.
Give me an example of one.
Well, let's see. The last. So this past season, where I was hunting in this section, or this little parcel I'm hunting is maybe this one's small. This one's like 15 acres. It's 15 acres that I can hunt on, but then next door it's there's, I don't know, there's maybe another 80, but I can't be on that. Mm-hmm. So I have this little 15 acre spot, and it's just a little narrow strip filled with ridges.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you look at it, if you look at it like looking straight into the timber, it's not flat. I mean, the whole thing, it is just, it's just doing this the whole whole way, and then it just has a giant ravine that dips all the way down, goes to like a creek bed, and then that's all another person's property. I think the aha moment on that one was when I had trail cameras out.
Mm-hmm.
on that specific place, and I was running cell cams. Mm-hmm. And I've only been running those for a couple years now. I just started getting into using the cell cams, which are great. The aha moment for that spot and that, or this season, this past season, and this specific deer that I killed was I finally figured out like where he was bedding.
Mm-hmm.
Every single time. And
was that because of cell cams? You found out where he was bedding because of cell cams. Okay.
Yep. Right. Yep.
And then I
figured out where he was bedding, and I maybe got 4 or 5 pictures of this specific deer coming from this certain place every single time. And I went in one day just more of just like scouting, and when I figured out like where he was coming from, because like on the camera you can see he came from specific place every single time, passed through, and he did that, you know,
same direction, like east to west,
same direction every single time. So I was like, okay, what is this deer doing that, you know, what is he doing that is he's coming from point A to point B? And I just, you know, went around when I knew he wasn't going to be in there, and just started looking around and just looking at the terrain and looking at like physically what I was seeing on the ground, what the cover looked like. and it and the aha moment was the actual like cover that he was in. Mm-hmm. And the stuff was, it was thick. I mean, it was super, super thick. Like, you would have to essentially just crawl on your hands and knees to get through there. And, you know, I was like, okay, so he's bedding this thick stuff, and then, like, super thick stuff. And then I started, like, realizing, I'm like, the deer before this past season, I was like, he was in the exact same stuff.
Yeah.
They're finding these thick, you know, super dense, thick little areas where they're protected. And almost they're at least on like this last place, he was bedding on like a ridge where he was able to like look down mm-hmm. and see everything in front of him. And like I said, it was super thick. So he could see everything in front of him. He was protected from behind, like he had the wind at his back if there was anything coming behind him.
Yep.
But that was kind of my aha moment of actually looking at what he was bedding in and then relating that to, you know, previous seasons.
Yeah.
On the different deer, different areas, but same features, you know.
So what was your attack strategy then at that point? You found you got a picture of him, and that picture indicated what direction he was moving consistently. Then you went in there on a day that you did not, that maybe the wind was wrong and you knew he wouldn't be in there, and you scouted, you found some thickness. Did you identify any sign at all?
Yeah, there was some, you know, he was scraping a little bit. He was running like a scrape line on these ridges. There was a couple rubs. There wasn't much like as far as like sign of during the rut. Mm-hmm. There was, and this was an early November kill anyway. So he wasn't seeking any does. And the thing about that spot too is like, not a lot of does in that area. So that's kind of what had me on the fence, you know? But yeah, there was definitely rubs, scrapes.
Gotcha.
Okay. Being in on those.
So you identified a bedding area. You got him on trail camera. So now the pieces of the puzzle are starting to come together. Describe what you did to get yourself in the position to to get a shot at this deer.
So went in a morning because I was, as far as like the cameras went, he was moving super early in the morning, like super early, like around that like 1-2 a.m. time period. Mm-hmm. And then I would occasionally see him come back through in the evening. And that was more like early October. So he was on that kind of pattern. And then, so I killed this specific deer. I think it was, November 4th. So it was just starting to heat up.
Yep.
And actually had a picture 2 days prior when I killed him. So, and he came through right at like 5 o'clock. The okay. same exact spot. So I was like, okay, like we're gonna go in here, see if he's gonna walk by at that specific time, which he didn't. And I kind of had a feeling that he wasn't, because that was going to be my luck. But I got in, and one thing we haven't talked about, or at least as far as like what my success has been, is rattling. That's how I killed this deer. Was being kind of in like his area, and was rattling. And that's how all my past bigger deer that I've shot now over the past 5 years has been rattling. So I get in, and you know, it's sun's just starting to break, and I'm like, shoot, man, he hasn't came through yet. So,
and you were expecting him to come through. I was like, expecting first light.
Yep, I was expecting him to come through first light because I mean that was kind of like his pattern that he was on. Mm-hmm. But once you get into November, it's like I mean there's that they do have patterns, but it's a little more frantic. Yep. And that's kind of where I like the rut, but I almost gotten to a point now where like the rut is for me at least. I kind of get a little. I wouldn't say paranoid, but it's a lot harder that I have found is,
Gotcha. And so when it comes to that, let me see here. When it comes to that particular buck, all right, you were close to him. You felt you were close to his bed. Okay.
Yep.
Why did you feel at that point that throwing the antlers up and trying to rattle him in was a good idea?
That's from Pat, from my past seasons. The deer before him, this would have been 2022. I was in an area, it was a farm that I grew up hunting, again, not really big, and I haven't actually hunted there for a while because it's one of my dad's buddies, and they go through and they shotgun hunt it like crazy. And I just kind of turned a blind eye to it, never really got out there. But then there's just this one day I brought my bow, brought my saddle, and I could literally like smell like rutting activity. So I was like, okay, I get up into a tree and I'm sitting there for, you know, 10 minutes, not seeing anything. And I rattle and sure as shit, like I see this big, didn't know what he was at the time. I just saw a big frame, mm-hmm. you know, tall. I see him kind of jump over this small broken up fence and he just came straight my way. You know, just snorting and wheezing like he was looking to fight, and did kind of the same thing for this past season. Was I didn't see him come through, through, you know, put the horns together, and sure as shit, like he came actually from behind me where I was expecting him to come from in front of me. He never came from that way, and he actually came from behind me.
Yeah.
So.
So you said the way the story is kind of playing out is you like to rattle during that pre-rut time frame before rut. Did you kill this particular buck in October?
I killed him. This one was November 4th.
Okay, November 4th.
November 4th. And it was still like, even though November 4th, that first week in November, like it's stuff starting to heat up. As far as like that area, there's not a lot of does in that area to begin with. So as far as like the action, it was more like that late October kind of
pre-rut
feeling. It was a time frame.
Yeah. Okay. So you rattled. He came in, and he got downwind of you, he came in behind you. Was behind you downwind, or did he catch your scent at all?
So the wind was actually coming. Let's see if I think about this. The wind was out of the east that day.
Yeah.
And so my wind was actually just kind of blowing into my face over my right shoulder, and he never got my wind, and when he came through behind me, somehow I don't know how he didn't get my wind. I do run a little bit of ozone when I am up in the tree. Mm-hmm. I think it's like, I can't remember who makes it. It's like dead downwind makes this little ozone generator. And then I think
it works. I don't think it's ozone. I think it's it's not. I don't think it's ozone because I think that Ozonics holds the patent for that. I think it's like an ion. They call it an ion generator or something like that. It's not ozone, but it's something else.
something else.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think what do they call it? I think they call it like Dead Zone or something. Yeah. I haven't really looked into it, really seeing what it is. And I have like a little one that like plugs into your car, you know, too.
Yep.
And, but don't know how he didn't get my scent, but I rattled and, he came from behind me, and only saw him for, cause I mean, this area that I'm in, that I found where he was bedding is just so thick, you know, I could see his feet for a second, and then I could see his body and his head, and then I'd go back to his feet, and it was just bouncing back and forth between there, and I could occasionally see like his rack, and I'm like, that's has to be that deer.
Yeah.
And he broke free just in a little small, probably no more than 4 feet wide. Mm-hmm. A little section in this thick, dense cover, and ended up let the arrow fly, and it was like 19 yards, yeah. 19 or 20 yards, you know, right in that. That's my favorite distance. I don't try to shoot any further than that, you know. And shot him and watched him, because on this spot that I was on, where if I revert back to kind of where he was traveling through, he was coming down a ravine and up the ravine, up onto this little flat area. And it's the only flat area on this whole property. It's maybe some 40 yards by 40 yards. It's just this little knob, you know, and then, when he was going through it, went back down a ravine, up and down, up and down. So it was just this specific little flat spot. And so when I shot him, and when he took off, you know, when he got hit, he was hit good. He stopped right at the edge of that ravine. And I was like, oh no. Like, I didn't know if he was going to go and take off down that ravine. That was gonna be my worst nightmare, was trying to have to drag him up. But no, luckily he actually went maybe 15 yards and just laid down right at the edge of that ravine before it takes off all the way down. So yeah.
Nice. And so did this buck do what other deer have done over the course of you hunting that particular spot?
So this particular spot, this was the like first big deer that I've killed on the spot. Now, as far as the situation went on the other properties that I've hunted, it's been very, very similar, situations, very similar hunts. Like the past, like, let's say probably five seasons, five good deer. It's been same type of area, thick, dense cover. It's been early to mid morning hunts where I've shot them, and it's been every single deer has came in to that rattle. Mm-hmm. So, and it's been with real antlers. Like I've tried with the fake, you know, plastic ones. They hear that, and I've had them take off and turn the other way. I found that using the real sheds. Actually, this deer, the deer that I used to, or like the antler, sorry, came off of a buck that I shot during late muzzleloader season. When I actually shot him, his rack fell off. So first time I've ever seen that. And so those are the horns that I carry with me. And, you know, they're good luck to me. So,
yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And so it sounds to me like mobile is the game. Relying on trail camera pictures, relying on terrain features, you know, basically the story that is out there, right? I mean, the using what you have, being observant, trying to do your due diligence when it comes to scouting, that kind of stuff, all leads to a successful year.
Yep.
How many years in a row have you been successful, would you say?
What was that? It cut out, sorry.
Yeah, how many years in a row have you been successful?
So as far as like being mobile and successful, I've been doing it, like I said, when I was in
12 years
high school. It took me, yeah, I've had success for, I mean, since I've started, I've shot something, you know, almost every year.
Yeah.
Not big by any means, you know, but as far as like the mobile game is concerned, the past 5 years have been super, super successful. And I don't think I can ever go back to the putting the two man ladder stands on the field edges, or, you know, preset stuff. I'm addicted to that mobile stuff now, you know?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, my friend, man, good conversation. Another fellow Iowan here. Good luck this upcoming season, man. And once again, thanks for taking time out of your day to hop on and chat with us today.
Yeah, 100%. Thanks for having me.